It's not every day that the senior enlisted advisor to the chief of the National Guard Bureau visits the Maniacs, but that's what happened. It was over the May UTA, so of course it was raining. That's a given, right? But we still had a full house, and SCA Reigns made his rounds meeting with our airmen, which is really cool. It's been a few months since our last podcast, so what better way to break the hiatus by talking with SCA Reigns? He joined the military in 1989, so he's been around a little while. So why not pick his brain and learn a little? Airman First Class Bridget Rosignol is our newest troop in the 101st PA shop, and she sat down and had the privilege to talk to him. So here's the interview. Hope you enjoy.
All right. Welcome back to the Maniac Radio Show, everyone. Different voice leading the charge today. I am Airman First Class Bridget Rosignol, and today I have the distinct honor of sitting down with the Senior Enlisted Advisor to the Chief of the National Guard Bureau, John Reigns. Sir, thank you so much for taking the time to do this today.
No, hey, it's my pleasure. I have enjoyed my few days spent here in Maine with the Maniacs, and I've got a little bit of history with Maine, with Chief Kelly Hofsis working down at the National Guard Bureau, and then I have an old buddy that was a mentor of mine that was a first sergeant on the Maine Civil Support Team, probably, I'm guessing, 2004-2005 time period, and I actually got a chance to connect with him on this trip. He actually came to the prayer breakfast the first day that we were doing engagements here. So it's been an awesome trip, and I look forward to this part as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So you've been in this role for about 6 months now, if I'm correct on that. So I'm sure every single day is different, but why don't you start with just walking us through kind of the main components or the daily ops of your very dynamic role?
You know, it's really multifaceted, and it's kind of changed a little bit from when I first started till there was this whirlwind event that happened on January 20th. You know, we had an inauguration with a new administration come in, and it sped the pace up for the military, which is a good thing. And when I say the military, I should be more specific. To the Pentagon. It sped the pace of the Pentagon up. And me and my boss were just getting our footing. General Nordhaus, the chief of the National Guard Bureau, he come in about 2 weeks, 3 weeks before I came in. So we started roughly at the same time. And we do the same thing, no matter if you're talking about the president, you know, who's the Secretary of Defense, you're talking about the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, or you're talking about the service chiefs, or my boss being the chief of the National Guard Bureau, who also sits on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. When you first come in, you got to establish your priorities, and you got to establish, hey, what's going to be our focus, you know, at least, you know, through this first year in the position. And then you kind of constantly reevaluate those and figure out, hey, do we got our priorities in the right place? So that's always a busy time, because how do you establish those priorities? You know, one of the ways you establish those priorities is higher headquarters. They tell you, hey, what their priorities are. Well, in this case, we were waiting for all of the new leadership to come in. So when you're waiting for them to come in, you're kind of in a hold pattern. So but we knew, you know, hey, priorities are always going to be homeland defense. You know, priorities are always going to be where the threat is, Indo-PACOM, in the Indo-Pacific. So we started looking at those things. What's looking at those things mean? It means getting on an airplane and going and seeing people, you know, which is one of the primary things that I do in the job, is build relationships. You know, I gotta know people in order to get things done for our units out in the field, our people out in the field. And everything starts and ends with people. So that's really a lot of the job, is being, you know, figuring out what those priorities are, figuring out what we want to focus on, and then developing those relationships to be able to get after those. And make things, you know, make sure our soldiers and airmen out in the field have the resources, have the time, you know, have the things that they need to get after the mission sets that feed the whole joint force. So that's really what I've been doing, is traveling around, you know, seeing, hey, where are we engaged at, where are we involved at. But the other side, and I've been telling the Maniacs this while I've been in Maine running around this week. as one of my big jobs is being the head cheerleader for the National Guard. So you can't be the head cheerleader of the National Guard without going around and seeing people and see what they do and you know, and hearing their stories. Because, you know, at where I'm at in my career, I'm not making a lot of stories these days. Now I've made a lot of stories throughout my 36 years, but you know, relevant, you know, recent stories, that's you guys. You know, that's what y'all are doing, out conducting your missions, out competing against other military service components in the competition space. And I'm not talking about the competition space, you know, as in war. I'm talking about the competition space and who can shoot the best, you know, who's the most physically fit, those kind of things. Because we do test ourselves that way. So anytime we win, and we win a lot, anytime we do well, I want to know those things. So I have to get out and develop those relationships and see what we're doing and seeing, hey, who's the best of the best. And anytime that's a guardsman or a guard unit, I want to know. So the only way to do that is to get out and you know, go around the force and be able to gather those stories so I can tell everybody else, you know. And it comes in important too when I'm over on the Hill. I'm working with Congress, whether it be members or whether it be staffers, and I'm talking to them, you know, about resources getting cut or resources that we just don't have that we need. It comes in, you know, it comes in pretty important to be able to show, hey, here's what we're doing with what we got right now. And here's what we could do if we had more.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you from a junior enlisted perspective that it's inspiring for me to see people at your level, you know, taking the time to come around to speak to and motivate, you know, different units and everything like that. So know that I very much appreciate it. So, as the senior enlisted advisor to the chief of the National Guard Bureau, what are your top priorities for enlisted guardsmen across the force?
You know, when you look at the priorities, that me and the boss both have established, I already told you everything starts with people and ends with people. So we take people and we put them in. If you envision, you know, a flywheel or circle, and you envision going around that circle, we talk about RPM. We talk about readiness, partnerships, and modernization. And then we just stay in there. And we just, I always talk about a car. And a tachometer, for one, RPMs, you know, is how you read a tachometer, revolutions per minute. Now, that's not a RPM we're talking about. We're talking about readiness, partnerships, and modernization. But when you rev that car up, that tachometer comes down, it goes back, it comes around, it goes back. Well, that's how I envision, you know, where we stay at and where we live at. So no matter if you're talking about the enlisted force, you're talking about, you know, what cohort you're talking about, officers. And now we have warrant officers in the air and the Army. It doesn't matter what cohort you're talking about. Everybody lives inside that. And they need to focus on those three things: building readiness, you know, building partnerships, because we do nothing by ourselves, you know, and then the modernization piece. As we field new equipment and new equipment gets given to our units, whether it be air platforms or, you know, whether it be just some individual piece of gear, we've got to be subject matter experts at our trade. And that includes knowing our kit and being able to employ our kit when we need it. So just staying inside that circle and just revving up, you know, for when the balloon goes up. So the balloon going up, hey, whenever we get deployed, whether it be to the border, whether it be fighting a wildfire, whether it be taking on an enemy, you know, whether it be, you know, China crossing the channel and going into Taiwan, and hey, what's our response to that? You know, that's the most dangerous course. So we got to be ready for the most dangerous scenario that we could likely be faced with. Yeah, so we stay in there and we build those things, and the hope is that we're so good at it that we project strength, which deters all of our adversaries, all of our enemies, and they don't want to test us, because they know the end result, if they face us on the battlefield, will be death. You know, so that's what we do. We stay in there. So that's my you know, that's mine and the boss's priorities to not just units. But that's our priorities to down to the individual. Stay in there, you know, get as, you know, proficient and become that expert where you do your job so much that you can't get it wrong in the dark.
Yeah. I like to say, you know, stay ready so you don't have to get ready.
That's
right. If you're always ready to go, you're ready to go.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. And on that topic, so with focusing on adaptability and readiness of our fighting forces, How important do you think it is for units to train in domains outside of their home station? You kind of alluded to this yesterday at the exercise, but I'd like for our podcast listeners to hear on that one too.
Well, hey, you know, I talked this with the unit yesterday with combat comms. You know, everything's easy at your home station. You know where everything is. You know, I think somebody brought it up there. One of the airmen brought it up. They said, hey, we were in Puerto Rico and we couldn't run back to the supply room and grab something if we forgot it. You know, and with their mission communications, it's just different. You know, you got everything hardwired here. You got everything. You got all the shots, you know, teed up, you know, what angle to put everything at, you know, where everything is. And communications just, you know, it's just second nature here because everything's the same. Well, it's not that way when we start talking about deployable combat wings. We start talking about, you know, agile combat employment. We start, you know, talking about doing things on a little island in the Pacific where we've never been. We're going to see things that we're not used to, whether it be the environment, whether it be the local population, you know, different languages, whether it be, you know, the security side of the house and defending ourselves against modern threats on the battlefield. All of that stuff is going to be different. And then our job, you know, is going to be a little different. But if we've rehearsed that thing and we've done it so many times that we can't get it wrong, you know, in pitch black darkness, then, hey, it's going to become second nature. We call it a battle drill. You know, a battle drill is a reaction drill. You don't have to think about it. You know, you've done it so much, it just becomes, you know, natural to you. And that's where we need all our airmen, and that's where we need all our soldiers to be.
So with the National Guard continuing to balance both federal and state missions, how do you see our role as guardsmen evolving in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, when we look at the priorities, you know, that have been clearly laid out in front of us, we see that, you know, reinvigorating the warrior ethos, rebuilding the military and reestablishing deterrence, you know, those are the three top line missions of the Secretary of Defense. And then the reason why is the two priority theaters, being the homeland and being Indo-Pacific, you know, the fight with China. So when I look at the future, I think that's really going to be our focus area, you know, in the future. We've got to make sure that we can defend the homeland, because that's where our families are. That's where the American people live at. So when we talk about that, we're talking about North America. You hear the Golden Dome brought up. You hear, you know, the southern border brought up, but not just the southern border, all our borders, you know, around the homeland we have to protect. We had these two big giant oceans that over time have protected us. We had two relatively, you know, stable neighbors in Mexico and Canada to where we didn't have to worry about them invading the U.S. But we have an enemy that can reach out and touch us now without regards to those two big oceans. So I think you'll see a lot of focus on the homeland. Certainly we'll play our part in that. You know, we're unlike all the other services and components of any service. We are in over 2,500 communities around the U.S. Nobody else is in that number. So when people think about the military, we're what they think about. You know, our professionalism sets everybody up and says, hey, the military, they're a professional organization. They're here when we need them. The Guard is the one that gives the military that reputation, unless you live outside, you know, 50 miles outside of one of our active duty installations. But that's not the majority of the American people. They know their military through the Guard, because we're in so many, you know, communities around the country. So I think that's gonna obviously continue to be important to us. But we are also on the Army side, we're 39% of the operational force of the Army. And on the air side, we're 30% of the operational force on the air side. So for us to believe that, hey, we're just going to be in the homeland and we're not going to be used, you know, across the oceans, wherever we're needed at, is really just a fallacy. Our services are going to need us to be a part of that joint force. They cannot do the mission without the Air National Guard and out the Army National Guard. And we need to talk to, you know, our soldiers and our airmen, and we need to make sure they know how big a piece they play in the security of our nation, both in the homeland and the Indo-Pacific, but all around the globe. But that's where I see us at. It's just, hey, we've had these priorities set for us and said, hey, these are the priority theaters. So I think you're going to see a little bit of shift. So where we might have been doing things at different parts of the world in, you know, a larger capacity. I think you're going to see some of that shift to the priority theaters, and I think you're going to see a little the importance of those two theaters a little more than what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. So breaking down that topic of the role of the guardsmen, focusing now on specifically drill status guardsmen, you were able to stop in at the exercise site of Grand Tour 2025 yesterday to debrief with the 265th and the supporting units. How vital is it that drill status guardsmen are taking place in training such as these?
Well, you know, you look at the mix. So the mix on the Army side is 80-20. So 80% is what we call drill and status guardsmen or traditional guardsmen. 20% is full-time. You look at the Air Guard, it's a 60-40 mix. So it's a little bit different. But do you want to go to war without your 40% being competent and without them getting the reps and sets in of their job? Because when we go to combat, it's not 8-hour days. You know, it's not, hey, we're going to work for 8 hours and we're all going to go do dinner together and then everybody's going to go to wherever they're staying at tonight and then we'll come back the next day and get started. No, war's a 24/7, you know, deal. It does not stop. So you can't go out there with 40% of your force not being proficient, you know, and I'll go back to, you know, the can't get it wrong in the dark again. You got to do enough reps and sets of whatever it is. It's your job. You know, you got to create them critical thinkers to where, hey, because no matter how much you train, there's going to be some element that you have not trained on, something that is going to surprise you. So you don't have time to be figuring out the things you know that you got to do every single day. You got to make those battle drills. So therefore, the things that come at you new from different places, you know, you can react to those things. You can figure those things out as you go. Well, we got to have 100% of our force operating at that level, you know. So when a drill and status guardsman comes in, and we think, hey, we're just going to put them doing the ancillary training. We're going to put them, you know, doing some of the medical pieces, and we're going to make sure they're ready. But we're not going to let them go out on the flight line, and we're not going to let them be maintainers, you know, that they are. We're not going to let them be communicators that they are. Whatever their career field is, whatever their AFSC is, we're doing a disservice to not just them. We're doing a disservice to the whole unit, and the adjacent units are going to operate with us as part of the joint force, because we've got to have 100% of our people, you know, being the best, being their best. And that takes reps and sets. So we got to have those drill and status guardsmen coming in and, you know, being just as proficient as the active people that work there every single day.
Absolutely. Here at the 101st, our air refueling mission plays a critical role in global mobility and deterrence. What message do you have for our airmen about the importance of this capability?
You know, I'll go back to 1990. Were you born in 1990?
10 years later.
10 years later. So I'll go back to 1990. This aircraft doesn't even exist anymore. But I was in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And I was eating dinner with my wife. We had our daughter who was less than a year old, and I'd come home from work, and she had cooked my favorite meal. I don't even remember what it was now because that was a long time ago. But I got a call, and the call said, "Hey, you know, whatever the word was, to come in and muster. You know, you got to come in. I was active duty, so you got to come in and muster." So I told her, "Hey, put my food in the microwave. I'll be back in a little while." I came home a year later. You know, I got on a 141 and I flew to Saudi Arabia for Desert Shield, Desert Storm. We refueled in the air, I think 2 times. It was like a roller coaster ride to me. You know, I don't normally get sick on an airplane, but during that time period, refueling in the air and, you know, not touching the ground, we didn't land anywhere. You know, we took off from Arizona and we flew and we landed in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And that's, you know, one of those things that reach is nobody else can touch that, mm-hmm. in, you know, the world when it comes to our military. And we know the things that are coming about when it comes to our tankers and the things that are getting put on the tankers that are collaborative. So therefore they do more than just refuel. The refueling mission is important by itself, but the other things they're going to be able to do with the modernizations that are coming is related to command and control and being able to communicate across, you know, the multi-domain and just the capabilities that they're going to be able to bring and that the whole joint force is going to count on, you know, because they got to be there anyway. You know, they got to be there. What good's a fighter without fuel? You know, they're not. So they're going to be in that area anyway. So we got to figure out, you know, some protection pieces and how we keep them, you know, there so we can continue to fight. But why they're going to be there, they're going to have some extended capabilities that's going to enable the joint force across multiple domains. And I mean, that's a huge part of the overall plan when it comes to how we're going to converge on the enemy at a time and place of our choosing. And we need all our airmen to understand that. We need a person that's doing the maintenance on that bird, that's doing the logistics side, that's loading whatever it is on there. We need them all to know that, hey, what they do for us is important in the overall mission, and here's how it fits in the total mission of the joint force. Because that gives people purpose, and we want people to have purpose. We want them to know that, hey, you know, whatever it is that their job is ties in to the joint fight in this way, and it enables us to win. And we need everybody to know that, because then, you know, they're going to put in those reps and sets. They're going to get after those things where it just becomes, you know, just natural instinct to do their job. And they're going to be the best at whatever it is they do and whatever they bring to the joint force for us. But this mission here is critical to you know, our overall success in the joint force.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, competence and you know, feeling important. It's in that hierarchy of needs. Everyone needs to feel that. And that's how you're going to, you know, motivate the people to keep doing their job and doing it well. So retention and readiness are ongoing concerns across the force. What do you think leaders at all levels from squad to command can do better to support our airmen and soldiers?
Well, hey, I want to debunk the myth that we haven't been doing good in recruiting and retention. We have been knocking recruiting and retention out of the ballpark. When we've been knocking it out of the ballpark for well over a year. You know, we had forgot how to recruit, and COVID really put us in a bad place. You know, we quit. I told you, I think first part of the discussion, we talked about relationships. Mm-hmm. That is a relationship business. You know, recruiting, it's hard to recruit over the computer, over the internet. You know, it's hard to recruit over the telephone. You know, you eventually got to look somebody eyeball to eyeball. You got to go talk to their parents, because most of the people we're recruiting, the recruiting age, you know, most of them, you know, their parents are a part of the equation. So we got to recruit families. And we always say that, too. We'll say, hey, we're going to recruit an individual, but we're going to retain the family. You know, so, I think number wise, higher than 80% of our force is married. So have a family or starting families. So we need to make sure that, hey, we're on the retention front, that those families understand what their service member does. We need to make sure they understand all the benefits and entitlements they have as being a military family. You would be surprised when we go around and we talk to spouses what the spouses do not know. You know, they have no idea about the TRICARE Reserve Select, that we even offer a medical package. You know, they have no idea that hey, if they have an installation near them, I drove by a commissary when I was coming in here, that hey, there's a commissary where you can go and you can save some money if you go shop here. You know, but just a multitude of benefits and entitlements that we got to be better communicators. We've got, if the service members aren't going to tell their family members, we've got to figure out how to communicate with those family members and, you know, get the word out of, hey, all the things we offer for the entire family. And I think that's a big piece of retention. But the other thing of retention that I fully believe in is I've never met a service member that left a unit, that left the Air Force mission, that left the Army mission. They leave leaders, you know, that hey, aren't being the best example of what we expect out of a leader. And I think that comes with other leaders not paying attention to what's going on below them. They've got to be involved at the higher level to know what they're, I always call it the 3 to 5, because the whole military is kind of set up in a 3 to 5 paradigm. Everybody's got 3 to 5 people they're responsible for. You know, I've got 430,000. What do you think I communicate with all 430,000? Hopefully, because they're all listening to this podcast.
Exactly.
You know, but in reality, probably not, right? So I got to break it down into you know, that size that I can actually have a real conversation with somebody, and that's usually about 3 to 5 people. So we have our councils, you know, that represent regions of the United States and all the units that are in that region, and we try to break those things. And I got executive councils that are over those regions. And then that's how I break it down into that 3 to 5 size. And that's the 3 to 5 people that I communicate with on a regular basis. So therefore, I can have a relationship, you know, that is well enough where I know their spouse's name. I know how many children they got. I know when they're not right and they're not on a game just by watching them or listening to them in a conversation. That's the kind of relationships we need our first line leaders to have, because all first line leaders usually not going to have any more than 3 to 5 people. We need them to have that kind of relationship with their 3 to 5. So therefore, you know, I'll give you an example. Somebody tells you, hey, what you doing this weekend? Hey, I got to move. I'm moving across town. I got a new place. And you say, hey, man, that's great. You need any help? You know, but go one step farther. Don't say that. Say, hey, what time you starting? I'm going to be there. And then call some more people in your 3 to 5 and get them to come over. And then I'll go to another kind of unit, a unit that never talks to anybody. So now you don't even know that person's going through a move. Moves are, you know, stressful. So you don't even know. Nobody talks to each other outside of drill weekend, you know. So what unit do you want to be a part of? You know, the one that's communicating and talking to each other, and they develop those relationships and those 3 to 5 size, you know, elements. So therefore, you can really get to know each other, and you know when they're having a problem, you know when they're having a stressful life event, and you can do something about it, you know. And I think that's on the recruiting attention side. The recruiting's taking care of itself. We're doing great, you know, and we're going to make some changes on the Air Guard side of the house where we're putting some recruiting commands similar to our Army National Guard side. You know, the only thing that's keeping us from executing that right now is the year-long continuing resolution. Congress has already authorized us, you know, almost 600 full-time positions to put out across the 54 states, territories, and District of Columbia so we can make that recruiting command structure. So we're going to start that soon. As soon as we get the financial side, you know, figured out, and the money comes with the positions. And that's what we're waiting on, only to continue resolution to stop that. So recruiting is going to take care of itself, but we got to make sure we're not after we invest and we get these people doing those reps and sets and they can't get their jobs wrong in the dark. Why would we want to lose them? You know, now they're ready to go, you know, fight. They're ready to contribute to the joint force. So we got to make sure we're doing that other piece right. And so we keep everybody on the team. So therefore, when we go to war, we're there with each other, with people we know, people we trust, and we know each other.
Yeah. Your point about the, you know, taking care of the 3 to 5 or knowing the 3 to 5, it relates back to, I'll never forget, I was in basic training and I was in a leadership meeting with the squadron commander. And piece of advice he said was the best thing a leader can do is delegate, which is something I'd never really heard of before, but it started to make sense. And it ties into your point that if you can delegate, you know, take care of 3 to 5 people, those 3 to 5 people can take care of 3 to 5 people and so on and so forth down the line. And that's how you cover those 400,000 plus that you were talking about. So
when you were saying that, that's what was going through my mind. Pretty soon you're going to get to 430,000.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. So for our junior enlisted members listening in, those like myself, what advice do you have for those looking to grow as leaders in today's National Guard? Because, I mean, you started out junior enlisted at one point way back when, right?
I did way back when, way back when. So, you know, I think don't be in a rush. Don't be in a hurry. You know, concentrate on your job at the time, you know, that you're in and be the best that you can be and be a good teammate. You know, the best teammate is the one that makes everybody else around them better. You know, so know your job well enough that you can kind of look around, you kind of see what's going on to your left and right, and you can see if somebody's struggling. Because usually the people to your left and right, that 3 to 5 again, they usually got the same job as you, because that's who you associate with in your unit. So kind of look around and see who's struggling, know them that well. So I think that if you do that and you learn all along the way, you know, we're going to give you increased responsibility. If you're the best one out there in your career field, you know, you're the best teammate. You're making everybody else around you better. You're gonna get opportunities to get promoted, and you're gonna keep moving up, and you're gonna have to learn more. You know, you're gonna have to go through your institutional training. You're gonna have to do your distance learning stuff. You know, you're gonna have to do all that. Take everything that you do as, you know, just a opportunity to develop yourself, which makes the whole unit better, makes the whole joint force better, and just keep doing that throughout your career. And I think next thing you know, you're sitting here at 36 years in service on a podcast, you know, as the senior enlisted advisor over the whole National Guard, and you think, where'd the time go? You know, and I think that's the approach that I've taken. I've never really worried about the next job. And I've been on my last job now for, I don't know, 12 years. I've been on my last job because, you know, when you start getting up senior, you know, as a state sergeant major, you're thinking, hey, that's it. I'm going to be done. And then you get selected to be the CCEL. And you think, well, this is certainly the last job, you know. And then you get selected to be the sergeant major for the whole Army National Guard. And you think, well, this has got to be the last job, you know. And then you get selected to be the senior enlisted advisor to the chief, representing the whole National Guard. And this is really it. I'm really done now. So, but if you follow that path, you'll never know where it's going to end.
Yeah.
And, you know, and pretty soon, you know, you're sitting here with 36 years of service, and you've had a great career, and you've met, you know, just countless numbers of people from all over the country, all over the world. There's really nowhere I can go in the U.S. where I don't know somebody. And there's few places I can go in the world where I do not know somebody. And when I say no, I'm talking about where I do not have a good friend, you know, that I could call and say, hey, I'm coming. I'm here. You know, you want to go grab something to eat? And they would say, hey, let's go get something. Since I've been here in Maine, I've got a there was a social media, you know, great thing. So somebody threw out one of, I think, the National Day of Prayer. They put it on Facebook. So one of the guys that I used to work with 15 years ago when I was a commandant at an NCO academy, he moved in Mississippi. He moved to Maine. He saw the thing on social media, and he said, hey, I talked to my brother, and you met my brother today. You know, he's in the Maine National Guard, Staff Sergeant, you know, Gathright. And I was like, you know, I forgot he even lived in Maine. Because I met him in Mississippi. I forgot he had moved to Maine. So I'm like, man, how cool is that?
That's awesome. Well, lastly, just to wrap it up, so we're all curious up here, with your experience as an Army Ranger, how do you like Maine?
You know, I love Maine, except for I'm having to carry a box of tissues around with me. You know, I'm sucking on a cough drop right now because my allergies, and I don't think it's Maine's fault. You know, I think it's the overall travel's fault. And it's a little bit of getting, you know, a little older. I've never had allergies in my whole life. You know, but as you get older, sometimes your little DNA things unzip and they throw something on you. So what's thrown on me a couple of years ago was allergies. Mm-hmm. So I was in Tennessee last week. I was in North Carolina this last weekend, and then on to back to D.C. for a couple of days, and now on to Maine. So besides my box of tissues and sucking on cough drops, I love Maine weather. This is great infantry weather. You know, do you know where you put a patrol base? You know what a patrol base is? Patrol base is where infantrymen hang out before they get ready to go do a mission. And where you put those patrol base is in a place nobody else wants to be. Mm. You know, it's got to be you know, thick cover, concealment, you know, we're off the beaten path, and probably cold, raining. You know, those are the best times for infantrymen. So I know Maine's not always like that, but in my couple of days up here, I've been an airborne ranger in a patrol base because that's the weather we've had these last couple of days. But I've enjoyed it. It's been a great trip. And I will tell you this, me and my wife is actually with me on this trip, which is awesome. And she's got a chance to talk to other spouses. She's got a chance to talk to, you know, your family programs here. And we both talked about, you know, the what we call hospitality in the South and friendliness. You know, you can't beat it here in Maine. Mm. I mean, the population here is just super approachable, super friendly. And, you know, I see why people brave the cold weather to live here.
It's worth it in the end. Well, thank you so much, sir, for taking the time to speak with me today. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your time up here at the 101st Air Refueling Wing.
Hey, thank you. And I look forward to the rest of my day spent with the Maniacs.
Awesome.
A huge shout out to SCA Rains and his team for making this episode happen. And a huge shout out to A1C Rosignol for conducting the interview and doing it well. Artificial intelligence might be making its way into many aspects of our lives, but good old human conversations cannot be replaced. Until they are. And then we'll have to find another closing line. But that's all we have for episode 68 of the Maniac Radio Show. I'm Senior Master Sergeant Andy Sinclair. Be sure to like and share this as it raises awareness on who the Maniacs are and what we do. Stay safe out there. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. So long.